Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 738. This episode is, do you guys want to, you have some Nerds Community Corkboard stuff you want to share with our audience?
You want to go first?
Sure. The newest episode of the Nerdist Writers Panel is a really awesome extra special one, and it features Steve Levitan, Phil Rosenthal, and Norman Lear.
Holy
Whoa!
Shit.
Yeah.
We did it live at Largo. At one point, Janae Dubois, who was in the audience, comes up and sings the Jefferson song and gets and like starts dancing with Norman Lear, which you won't be able to see in the audio, but you can hear
it. Holy
and
shit.
It's great. Yeah. It was amazing. It was so interesting. If anyone is interested in TV writing, you have to listen to it.
Way to go, Ben Blacker.
Yeah. And it's up right now, so you can get it Nerdist Writers Panel.
I'm going to go listen to that immediately.
My God. Mm-hmm.
Top that, Kyle.
See, when you said very special episode, I was hoping it was Ben Acker got like addicted to pills and Ben Blacker has to help him.
That wouldn't be very special.
I got I got a fun website called NewJerseyIsn'tBoring.com.
Yep.
And our friend Sid sent this in because he of the Nerdy in New Jersey section.
Uh-huh.
That's literally entirely dedicated to, we're talking comic book stores, arcades, ghost tours.
All right.
Like all sorts of cool stuff that you can do, Rocky Horror Picture Screenings, stuff within New Jersey. So if you're a nerd, you're in New Jersey, and you think that it's boring, go to New Jersey Isn't Boring and be
Nerd
proven wrong.
Nerd Jersey.
Excellent. Thank you, Kyle. This episode is Andy Daly, who is returning to promote Review on CC.com, the Comedy Central app, and Hulu. Of course, it's had its run, its second season on Comedy Central. Hopefully, there'll be a third season. But Andy Daly is one of the comedy entities that I will always stop whatever I'm doing to watch. Especially if he's performing live.
I just like looking at him. He makes me giggle. Like, because you know he's up to something.
He's so fucking funny. He just makes such great, strong choices, comedy choices, and he commits the shit out of them.
And they're always real weird choices that
and
you're like, this was the best choice.
Oh my God, yeah. I adore him. And we got to do Comedy Bang Bang together a couple years ago, and he was so much fucking fun. Anyway, Andy Daly Review. See it on the internet. Here's Nerds Podcast number 738 with Andy Daly.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Wait, are you just getting into Twilight Zone?
Them as a kid, but I don't remember them.
We're gonna put together a list for her.
Well, you have to watch the first one. It's called The Last Man on Earth, and you have to watch that one. That sets up the whole series. It just sort of.
Next stop, Willoughby.
Willoughby. The Willoughby episode is fucking great.
They're all good.
I mean, the thing.
They're not all good.
They're not all good, but there are. They're mostly all. The thing that was so interesting about it is that, you know, Serling was basically making a lot of social commentary, which at the time he was able to do because the show was surreal. And so he was able to comment on what was going on in culture without directly attacking anyone. So there's a lot of stuff in there about prejudice and a lot of stuff in there about. You know, about the Cold War and paranoia but some of them get really great and psychological. You really have to. There should be all on Netflix, right? You can just start. Yeah, yeah.
There's always a 4th of July marathon too. You can wait till July.
You know, there's one called Eye of the Beholder, which is really great because there's a big thing in there about people wanting to be beautiful all the time and vanity and narcissism. The show's. You know, I feel like even the bad ones are still. I mean, you probably don't. I would stop short at Twilight Zone and not drift into Night Gallery territory, which is the show that he did in the 70s. But because that's more of just like a weird Outer Limits horror type show. But Twilight Zone, spot on. I mean, it's you really have to. I can't believe I'm pitching the Twilight Zone. You ever heard of the Twilight Zone?
Citizen Kane.
I mean, there just wasn't. It's, you know, so many things. It might seem boring to people now because you've seen stuff like that before, but they did it. It was you have to understand when that came out.
Sometimes the twist at the end is like like it's you know what I mean. Sometimes the episode will just get you that, but still, it's worth the ride. The acting is always so it's great.
There are some phenomenal actors in there, and then people that you. It's weird to see older character actors that you recognize, but young. In Twilight Zone, right. Shatner's in an episode.
He's in a couple.
Nimoy's in an episode. Isn't Nimoy in an episode? Nimoy's in an episode,
Nimoy,
I think.
Nimoy? Savalas.
Oh, Talkie Tina. That's the Talkie Tina episode.
Oh, it's so good.
Man, what if this whole episode was just us going, oh, oh, and then the diner? Oh, and then the fortune teller?
Yes.
Oh, all the old people with the, all the family with the masks?
The astronauts? Remember the astronauts?
Oh, the astronauts! Kid, you love Agnes Moorehead, right? Agnes Moorehead? Star Bewitched? Huh? Come on, Katie. It's like, it's just pitching names to people that they just possibly.
Burgess Meredith?
Huh? Burgess Meredith? Love Burgess. Burgess Meredith. He's the best.
It's all Burgess.
He's got some good ones. Oh, and then there's a phenomenal episode with Buster Keaton.
That's the best one in my opinion.
It's so meta. It starts out like an old timey movie where it's got the dialogue cards and then the piano, and he's moving around really fast, and it's basically him like in the 1800s, and he's a janitor for a scientist, and the scientist builds a time machine, and he talks about going into the future to this. It's very kind of H.G. Wells, but he goes into the future to live in this utopia because he wants to see the utopian society of the future, and he lands smack dab in the 60s. And then it all of a sudden there's sound and it's really loud and it's him then trying to figure out how to get back because the future is actually he does speak in the when he gets to present day in the 60s, he finds out that it's a very dystopian future and he wants to go back.
Fast moving the 1800s.
So it's all good. It's all good, yo. That's what Rod Serling could have said. It's all good, yo. Yes. Anyway, Andy Daly, we're here to talk about your show, The Twilight Zone.
Oh, yes.
Wait, did you like the 80s Twilight Zone?
Are you doing this now?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, have we been? I got up and blew my nose in the middle of it.
That's all right. Well, you're picking your butthole right now. Oh, I wouldn't do that if this were the show. It's just an audio podcast. Well, I know, but people can tell. People know when I... Maybe Forrest should review a Twilight Zone. Maybe Forrest should review like a Twilight Zone twist or like an M. Night Shyamalan thing where there's a weird... Where you could review the surprise twist ending.
I think that's exciting. Yes. Well, we sort of did with our racism segment. We thought of it as a Twilight Zone-esque episode where he's trying to determine what it's like to be a racist and then discovers that he's been one all along.
We did in the writing room talk about that like it's a Twilight Zone ending. But you guys are you're already done now with season two, right?
Yes, it's episode 7 has just aired, and we're done making it. I hope to God we're done making it. I don't want any more emails about decisions that have to be made.
Do you not like that part? Would you rather just be a performer?
No, but I wish that stuff were easier, and I wish I wish it was just I wish it took less time, and it was possible to just kind of. Always know the right decision to make in the moment when it has to be made and never look back, as opposed to lots of email volleys and lots of second guessing and lots of times when you're positive about something and then a week later you're subjected to your decision and go, no.
I was so sure.
I was so sure.
I knew it. What was I thinking? Yeah, that's
a lot of that. It goes on forever. I mean, post-production was like 7 months long.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was a long damn time.
You must have a shit ton of extra footage.
So much extra footage, yes. So much extra footage and so much, too, because we have so much narration, you know, that we can go back later and rewrite and remake things in huge ways because we have the device of this narration, which is a blessing and a curse. Because it's a writing job for a solid year.
God.
Yeah. It never ends.
Now, would you want to do a season 3 or are you ready?
Yeah. No, for sure. Absolutely. Oh, it'd be so much fun to do a season 3. I mean, yeah, I think there may have been a time toward the end of post before it started airing when I was like, you know, as I was saying, I was like Apollo Creed at the beginning of Rocky 2. There ain't going to be no rematch. Ain't gonna be no rematch, but you know, because it's the beginning of a movie, there's gonna be a rematch. He's saying it, you know, he's lying.
Yeah, they wouldn't just end the movie.
That would be a weird, a 10-minute long Rocky 2. Although it might have been better. Rocky 2 is not great.
No. They really tried to, and I can't decide if Rocky 3 is great. I remember loving it when I was a kid, but I haven't seen it since I was younger.
I watched it pretty recently. It is a remarkable jump in tone from 2 to 3. 3, they just said, like, let's just hit the ground running. We got Hulk Hogan. We got Mr. T. This is fun, fun, fun.
Yeah, that one's all about hubris,
yeah,
basically.
It's just a tight carnival ride, that thing. And then, whereas episode Rocky 2, there's literally like a 45-minute shopping sequence. Like, all the, and there's a massive amount of time that he's looking for a job. It's like, it's so boring. And then the training sequence, which you think of as like the big thing that happens in those movies, is like a minute long.
Oh,
it's
wow.
So short.
Well, they really did, because in 4, he, like, they all really do kind of have an arc to them, which I can respect that fact. And then 5 is completely different than 4.
5 is the only one I never saw.
It's actually not bad. Really? They lose everything.
Oh.
When they go to Russia, they leave Paulie in charge of everything for some reason.
So it picks up right where it left off.
It picks up right where it left off.
And from Russia.
And in the beginning of 5, it starts off where he's in the shower after the fight with Ivan Drago.
Oh.
And his hands are shaking because he's been hit in the face so many times. Sure. And he basically just got hit by a guy the size of the Kremlin.
Yes.
And so he's
part robot. That guy was part robot.
He's all fucked up. And then for some reason, and this they kind of gloss over, but I can't imagine they were in Russia for more than a few weeks. But for some reason, they felt like that if someone wasn't manning their finances for a couple weeks, they were going to be ruined. So they turned everything over to Paulie, who then ruined them. And then so they go back and they've lost everything somehow. They're not clear about that. And so they just have to move back to the streets of Philadelphia. And, you know, Adrian gets a job working in the salon again, or a pet shop or whatever it is. And, you know, then Rocky takes on a protege, this guy named Tommy Gunn, who then that fight sequence is the end, is them street fighting. So there's not even like a big boxing match in that.
Rocky versus Tommy Gunn in the street.
Rocky versus Tommy Gunn in the street. Yeah, they just fight each other in the streets of Philadelphia.
Why have I never seen this? This sounds great.
It's not. yeah. So then that, and I actually haven't seen, I didn't see the one they just did a couple of years ago.
That one I loved.
It was good?
Yes, I love it.
Okay, I'm going to go back.
It's just called Rocky Balboa, I think.
Yeah.
But it's good. He figured something out.
What did he figure out?
You know what? I heard him in an interview saying about Rocky 1, which, by the way, there's a whole big complicated thing as to whether or not he wrote that. You know, like, it's a whole thing. Like, that all sounds. There was an article a few years ago that there was a lot of theatrics to that story, and we were sold kind of not the exact true story. But anyway, that he was saying that, like, he was like, if I could get at the themes, the big themes for this age that I got at in Rocky 1, that's what I would like to do with Rocky Balboa. And to whatever extent he succeeded or not, you can see that was the effort of Rocky Balboa.
Right.
And it works on some level.
I got to go back and watch it. I guess I just sort of felt like, it's probably more of the same business over and over and over and over and over again. And then there was that old Airplane 2 joke where you see the poster and it says like Rocky 34 or whatever. And it's just this old guy with these gloves, like this decrepit old
man. It was
like
a 90-year-old Asian man, if I recall.
It really was. Like, it was.
What happened there? Age doesn't explain it.
Yes. So when Rocky gets a lot older, he just jumps races. And
it happens. You see it.
If you want to win this, you got to be an old Asian man, Rock. That's how committed I am.
It happened 10 movies ago. You turned Asian.
I feel like Stallone's done a pretty good job, though, staying. I mean, The Expendables was a decent recent franchise.
Yeah.
Has he been in anything else in the last? Oh, yeah. The trailer for that looked pretty cool, actually.
What the hell?
It's kind of impressive, you know, to like keep a franchise, you know, going for 40 years. So, you know, we're getting a new Rocky movie, a new Star Wars movie.
I'm happy to be done with Rambo.
Yep, that's all done.
That's done, right?
I feel like that's got to be all done.
Right? Good.
Although Rambo, there could be Son of Rambo. You know, I know there was Son of Rambo, the joke.
There was? Oh.
But there, as a joke.
Oh.
But I feel like there could be another John Rambo. I'm surprised it hasn't been fired up yet. I'm actually surprised that that hasn't. It's probably in the works. But, you know, there's probably a million things that we'll never hear about because they're just stuck in studio development land.
Mm, yeah, that's probably true.
What would you go back and redevelop if you could?
Oh, you know what? I'm very curious to know about the... there was talk of a sequel to Midnight Run. Midnight Run is one of my favorite movies of all
course.
Time. And I know I saw an interview with Charles Grodin where he was... he goes, I have been told that someone is going to visit me to try to get me to do the sequel to Midnight Run, and I have expressed my willingness to meet with this person.
That was like, that was his statement on it. It was just
it's
like
a bummer that he doesn't, that you don't see him more. I know. I think he doesn't like to travel. I also read the thing with him with Louis C.K. wrote him a nice note and said, like, here, it's a job in New York and I'd love you to do it. And he was very receptive to a nice note.
Right.
So if you're shooting on the East Coast, if it's a drive from his home in Connecticut and the note is nice enough, you can get him.
Then Charles Grodin, then he'll do it. So maybe the Midnight Run people just need to put pen to paper.
Right.
Just Robert De Niro's got to say, like, you know, dear Chuck, it's Bobby. Let's put on the running shoes, quote unquote, one more time.
Shoots in Hartford.
Somebody pitch this at Midnight Run, right? So we get Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro on the panel.
Yes,
De Niro would be great on At Midnight.
Yes,
actually, Charles Grodin would be great on At Midnight. I would have Charles Grodin on in a second.
Oh my god,
I would have Charles Grodin on in a second.
I don't think he'll travel.
What do you think what do you think about the intern, the De Niro movie that's coming? I actually auditioned for that.
So did I.
You did. I never auditioned for anything.
I did. That's so funny.
And I auditioned for it. How did it go for you?
I'm not in it.
Me neither.
Yeah. I don't remember. I don't even remember. I think I auditioned to be like a jerky boss or something like that.
I auditioned to be...
Yeah, like jerky coordinator of the interns or something like that.
I auditioned to be Anne Hathaway's husband.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't get that.
You didn't get that?
No.
Well, people are making all these jokes about it. Why? Are they meant to be romantically linked? I probably did not read the entire script.
No. At least
sometimes I do.
The version sometimes that I saw, they were not meant to be romantically linked.
I thought that was what everybody was goofing on because it seems to be, shall we say, trending on Twitter, the Hathaway and De Niro. And I thought that the joke
I hope
is
not.
Yeah, I don't want to see
them in the
a
version
romance.
That I saw in the version that I read. They do not.
Okay.
No, not to give any spoilers, but it was more of an avuncular relationship.
Uh huh.
Then, guess I go to fucking now. Like it wasn't, which, why did that make you giggle? Anyway, we've all learned a very valuable lesson here today. You
De Niro?
Could take charge of your own. No, that's my Hathaway.
No, that I buy. I buy it as a Hathaway.
These are my Princess Diaries. Turns out this is Harry Potter for girls. And I'm now a princess. Hello, Julie Andrews. Are you talking to me, Julie Andrews? That's the fucking worst.
What's that? That's Hathaway as De Niro?
Very confusing, but it works. It works.
I don't know if it works. What is your worst impersonation?
My worst impersonation? I don't know.
You're not really an impressionist.
Bad. No, I'm not an impressionist. I was just thinking about, I'll tell you my best impression.
Please.
Because that's, when I auditioned for Saturday Night Live in 1999, I knew I had to do impressions. Like, that's part of the deal. And I've never really tried them before. But the only one that I did was Hunter S. Thompson as like a 62-year-old man.
Uh-huh.
Because I saw him in an interview once in Charlie Rose, and he's just going, He never finished a sentence was the best part. And Charlie Rose just barrels into the next question because every answer is, well, yeah, I mean, Richard Nixon was responsible for driving all of the best people out of politics. And Clinton, you know, Clinton, of course. But, you know, well, I had to live with that. Oh, no.
Yeah, it just made no sense. Yeah, that was my impression.
I thought you were going to go back and forth. You're going to do Charlie and then
oh,
go back
Charlie,
into,
right?
Yeah.
Well, Charlie spent that interview. Right, right, right. And then you wrote the Rum Diary.
So they were just neither one of them. Right? They were just having individual conversations.
Exactly.
That sort of crossed over because they were sitting across from each other.
It was frustrating to watch because I was waiting. I was like, he's going to pull it together. He's going to pull it together and make a full sentence out of this. And then Charlie Rose would ask the next question.
I don't think I've ever seen Charlie Rose blink. I feel like,
yeah.
I'm not sure if I've watched him. I just stare and was like, sooner or later he's got a blink, and then I don't actually.
They cut away. No, they always cut away for the blinks.
I don't actually see it happening. I wonder if someone's just leaning in and just doing with the eyedropper, just like just moistening his eyeballs. I don't know, but I don't know if I've ever actually seen him.
He's
blink.
Odd. He's reptilian.
Yeah. I wonder if that would be a fun show to do or a terrifying show to do?
It looks scary to me. It looks, I don't know what it is about the sparseness of the space that it's just like, it's just you and him and you better have answers to every one of these fucking questions.
Because he pretty much owns, I would so love to find out what his process is.
I've heard he's a hellraiser, Charlie Rose, believe it or not.
You mean in real life?
Like he parties like a motherfucker, Charlie Rose.
I think a lot of those old news guys probably do.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe when they're reaching over the eyedropper, it's just like scotch. They're just moistening his eyes with scotch, and he's just absorbing it right there. Yeah. Those
so
guys,
he and Thompson were both just completely hammered during that interview. They
how amazing
no
would it be if
it.
They just went down? Like, there must have been an epic drink off down.
Oh, yeah.
In whatever.
So are we
going to
fucking do this right now? Oh, well, I mean, we're going on
you're not
going
to mumble your way out of this one, pussy. We'll be right back. And they just come back, and there's just a stack of empty glasses. Right there. They're doing the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Bastardi!
Of course, you get enough ice, put it in your glass.
That would be amazing, the epic drink-off between Charlie Rose and Hunter S. Thompson. He must have the best. There's so much about Charlie Rose that I would love to dissect. But I just don't know if you could. I just don't know if he would make himself available in that way.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I'm sure he's had a fascinating life.
Would he be the interviewee for once?
That's the question. Has he ever been the interviewee?
I'm sure he has. I'm sure someone's.
Because what an interesting juxtaposition that is. If he is out fucking partying every night like a wild man, and then he comes and sits at that wooden table in front of that black curtain and gives the most staid professional interviews.
But some of those guys, like some of those, if he is, again, I don't know, but if he is one of those old grizzled career drinkers,
right.
There's a certain type of person that could literally drink until 4 a.m, go home, sleep for an hour, get up, shower, throw on some Aqua Velva, and then be right at your desk the next morning. I mean, it sort of feels like, I would imagine sort of, they probably smell like the newsroom from All the President's Men, like those old newsrooms that are just like leathery ashtrays, you know, like
everybody slept in their suits.
And they're just, it's just nonstop drinking. It just never, ever, ever stops.
Yeah.
Breakfast scotch, lunch vodka. Oh,
sounds good.
then head over to the, but I think the downside to that lifestyle is, I think when you hit like 60, 70, I think your body is not.
I would hope so.
Not.
I would hope there are some repercussions to living like that.
I feel like our generation probably has the highest number of more responsible. Like people are so much more aware now. I know people still do drink a lot and do a lot of drugs and stuff, but I think our generation is probably a little bit more aware of what the repercussions of all that lifestyle are.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an odd thing that like you would not have been labeled an alcoholic for drinking, like getting pretty buzzed during lunch every single day as a businessman, like what, 30 years ago?
I mean, I would imagine you and I are similar in the sense that it doesn't seem like you go and tear shit up.
No.
At all.
I don't believe I've ever torn any shit up.
I'm just glad that you know, that a handful of, because there is that
that mythos of the comedian or the performer. It's like, oh, they're so, they got to be super damaged and super fucked up, and that's what makes them fun. And I feel like you don't, you know, that's a choice. But yeah, you could also just be pretty even keeled and still be funny.
Yeah, I have that thing too of like, you know, comedians always have a troubled past. It's kind of like, probably the same number of accountants have like rough childhoods. You know what I mean? It's just not ironic. So, there's no like, yeah, the tears of a clown.
Yeah,
people like to talk
about. It's okay to be. It's okay to be happy in general. I think it's all right. It's
right.
It's not terrible. I don't think it ruins anything. You know, you can still.
Yeah.
You can still deconstruct things without, you know.
Yes, probably it helps for a comedian to have felt like an outsider at various times, right? Because it gives you a different perspective, I would think. But then again, John Belushi was like, you know, class president, captain of the football team and whatever. And that didn't seem to stop him from being hilarious.
But maybe inside he felt like an outsider.
Yes,
you never know.
As an Albanian.
That's probably.
You know. He may have felt like an outsider. Yeah.
But I really did used to. I wonder if everyone feels like an outsider. You know, I think, you know, when I was growing up and being, you know, like the group that I was in felt very outcast. But I wonder if even the kids who are popular, do you think they feel outcast at all, or do you think that maybe they don't and they're just shallow?
My perception now of people who were popular in high school, with all this hindsight, is that that was a desperate place to be, actually, that it was hard to maintain that position and that it was insecure. But I don't know if that's true, if that's just me putting that on it all these years later.
Yeah, because I there definitely is this syndrome, the peaking early syndrome, you know, and I think when you're young and things are very easy for you in terms of, you know, popularity, people just wanting to going out of their way to try to please you, that it doesn't generally, unless you're broken in some other way, it doesn't really force you to be very introspective, because you don't have to be. You can live very much in the external world and everything's brought to you, and you don't really have to second guess things or think about things because it all just comes. And I think, you know, being ostracized does force you to become more introspective, because you start asking a lot of questions. Well, why is this this way? Why is this not easy for me? What am I doing wrong? And what's this? And I think it sort of forces you inward, which going too far inward, I think, is also detrimental.
Yeah, and I guess it also forces you to say, like, you know, what is my way, you know, to proactively feel successful in life, as opposed to somebody who's just like, I'm good at this thing and everybody loves me for it, so here we go.
Yeah.
You know.
What group were you in when you were in high school?
In high school, was I even in a group? Yeah, no, I had an odd existence in high school, because my friends were very smart and very well accomplished and very headed for Ivy League schools and stuff like that. And those were my friends, but my grades were very terrible. But I sort of hung with that crowd, and I was in a band of people who were all going to go on to good schools. Like, you know, we were in a rock band, and I was the only one that was secretly fucking out of classes.
But you look like you'd have good grades. You had the right haircut and glasses for it.
I had kind of long hair in high school. I was trying to be a hippie, but didn't quite know how to pull it off.
Sure.
So that was a problem. But no, I don't know. I couldn't do things I wasn't interested in. Just I could not apply myself to things that didn't interest me. But even then, even though I was interested in English and history, let's say, I had no interest in math or science. Like, I just could not engage. But even the things I was interested in, I would turn in papers weeks and weeks late. All the time. Every paper I ever got back had like an A crossed out and then a D for lateness.
Here's what you could have had.
Yeah, yeah, again and again. But I don't really know why. I've never quite known exactly why I did that. But except that maybe there was something fun about living in that kind of chaos, because it was very stressful.
But maybe it was just hard to motivate yourself, like you said, to do stuff that didn't interest you. I mean, that is a very hard lesson to learn. Well, yeah, sometimes you got to do shit you don't like doing, and when you're young, you know, you can still get away with, nah, I don't feel like this. You know, if you don't really care about what college you're going to,
right?
That's kind of the only
motivating factor for why you should work hard in school is like, well, you know, later in life, or if you don't go to this college, you don't go to this, you're gonna die because you can't survive and get a job. But if you remove that, there isn't really much outside of your own sense of achievement that would motivate you to turn shit in on time.
Yeah, right. So I would read a book and I would enjoy it up to the point where I got bored with it, which is what I do now in life. Like, I'm enjoying a book, but I don't need to finish it, you know, and put it away, you know, or whatever. And then I'd write a paper on it if I felt like I had something to say about it. You know what I mean? Like, that was kind of the way I approached school, because the threat of not going to a good college, not getting into college, didn't mean anything to me, because I had no vision of myself in the professional world later. I just couldn't see that until I read an unauthorized biography of David Letterman that said that he went to college and majored in communications at Ball State, doing television and radio, and that was like, oh, you can do that. Okay. Now I can imagine myself going to college. That was the first time
I've wasted all this time.
Yeah.
I've really fucked myself. It's too late now.
Yeah.
Well, it is kind of funny to think back about how terrified, you know, when I was in school, how terrified it was for, well, if I don't get, you know, good grades, I'm not going to go to college. And if I don't do that, there. But when I look back, I'm like, I don't know if that, I mean, I guess I did. It didn't really matter. I mean, it is, I think it's more for your own sense of, you should learn how to acquire knowledge, and you should learn how to be able to do that, because that skill set is helpful in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
But in and of itself, when I look back now, I sort of think like, I mean, I guess, you know, sure. But you impose that upon yourself or other people, when your parents tell you like, okay, your permanent record's very important.
Right.
But I don't know how – I mean, my permanent academic record hasn't really affected me much in quite a while.
No, I don't get
that. I'm aware of.
Asked about my GPA very often.
And you're doing very well with, you've completed shows and series and movies, and you didn't leave your kid in a diner because you were just bored.
Right.
You know, like, so it seems like you came out
okay. Well, even in high school, like, the things that I was really interested in, I worked at around the clock, like, tirelessly. I got tirelessly into things, but I just did not have time for things I wasn't interested in. So I don't know what kind of education I should have had, but it does feel like there are some like private school educations that are tailored toward people like that. Like, oh, here's what you're interested in. Go that way.
You were in a band?
Yeah, I was in a band.
What did you play?
I played drums.
You did?
Yeah.
Do you still play?
I do. Sometimes I have an electronic drum set I bought to be more considerate to my neighbors, but it's not as fun.
Because you can't really.
Yeah.
You can't really feel. You're not disrupting anything.
Yeah.
I think in a percussive instrument, you kind of want to be a little disruptive.
I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. Hitting pads.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or drumming on your steering wheel.
Right.
Is not as. Just seeing dudes practicing, just drumming on their steering wheels in traffic.
Yeah, you can tell. Maybe that's not, a drummer. That's maybe, a frustrated drummer.
That is a guy. Mm-hmm. That's someone who's trying to learn their craft a little bit more.
I think I need to get a real drum set. And just because after I bought the electronic drum set, I suddenly noticed various places in my neighborhood, people are playing real drums. Nobody gives a shit.
They don't.
You know, but you also, you're not doing it after 11 o'clock at night.
You know, I'd still feel bad, though.
I would.
I do feel bad because I'm very much aware of when other people... I have a real pet peeve about people affecting the experience of everyone around them and being oblivious to it. There was a woman in Starbucks a couple days ago, and she was waiting at the counter, and she had a small, adorable dog, but the dog was on a really long leash.
Oh.
And she was just gabbing on the phone, and the dog was running all around the Starbucks and kind of forcing people to have to step over the lead or not trip with their
she
drinks.
Had no idea.
No fucking interest or care that, you know.
Stuff like that makes me scared for how many times in life I'm doing things that I have no idea that I'm doing it.
But the fact that you even have that thought means that it's not. And if you did, I feel like you would catch yourself. Even if for a second you were like, oh, I'm sorry. And you would scoop up the dog and hold the small dog so that everyone else didn't have to trip over it.
Right.
and so because of that, I really do my best to try to be aware in public situations. Am I affecting everyone else in this immediate – or like dudes – there are dudes who just sit on airplanes and just fucking watch videos on their iPhones with no headphones.
Yeah.
Or just talk on speakerphone.
Yes.
In a small, intimate space.
I don't know how loud my conversations are on my cell phone, though, when my earbuds are in. You know what I mean? That's something that recently occurred to me. Because sometimes there'll be somebody on an airplane or something like that before it takes off who is yelling into the phone.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to pick us. You can pick us up at, yeah. We're going to land around 4. Right. And then we got to get the luggage. Yeah, I don't know. I went to the doctor. I had it checked out. It's still, it's kind of in the, it looks like a cauliflower. There's a little bit of chalking. I don't know. Oh, hang on. They're telling me I got to turn off the phone. I don't know what's going through people's heads when they are in public and shouting on phones or playing things with that. Yeah. I think they just literally don't give a shit.
That's probably it. Yeah. There are people that just don't give a shit.
And are they wrong or are we wrong?
I think they're wrong. Yeah, I think they're wrong. Because nobody's annoyed with you if you do give a shit. There's no way to give a shit too much.
I guess.
About disturbing people.
Do you, how many kids do you have?
2.
You have 2 kids.
Yeah.
Have you traveled with them?
Yes.
And so what's that situation like?
That's fine. Actually, it's weird how fine it is to spend an entire day traveling across the country with an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old is always something we are braced for disaster, and it always is a delight.
How did you manage to?
Well, because of iPads and headphones. That's really the answer. It's as simple as that. You just load up the iPad the night before with things that they can't believe they get to sit here and watch all
Red
day.
Tube.
Yes, exactly. All that stuff. Yeah.
Red X hamster, you know.
It's yeah. X hamster.
These are, I'm guessing, I don't know, right? Kyle?
You know those are true.
What? I don't know, I was just making those up.
That's so specific, though.
True for what?
Why would you put X and hamster together? You can see the logo clearly in your head and close your eyes.
What? Well, I assume it's probably some sort of a hamster. I'm guessing.
What was on the splash page, Dick Riss?
Something to do with bowel control. I don't know. I'm just guessing. I don't know. I don't know. I think Andy is pleased that he's on a podcast and the person at the other end isn't looking him up while.
While I've had that experience.
He's being interviewed.
I have had that. What are you looking at your screen the entire time we're talking? Well, that's my IMDb page. This is interesting.
And this person that we won't name, whose podcast you were on, this person with the Deadwood aesthetic who lives in a garage, you
Deadwood aesthetic.
You guys know each other, right?
Yes, for a long time.
And the entire time looking at your IMDb page.
It's like, are you reading your emails while you're interviewing me? What could be on that screen? Oh, I see. It's basic information about me.
And you got blonde hair.
Yeah, I do.
I do.
You were in the cast of Mad TV from 2000 to 2002. Yes.
Your appearances as self also include late show, formerly with Craig Ferguson. What was that like?
Well, that was a
time. It was a time. But anyway, we were talking about it anyway. Maybe Ian McShane has a podcast, and that's what we were talking about.
Could be anybody. Or no one at all.
Or nobody. It could be nobody at all. No, we just don't know. We can't prove it was everyone and no one.
Yes, exactly. Like the Twilight Zone.
Yes. When everyone is beautiful, then no one will be. Katie, you've got to watch the Twilight Zone. I mean, seriously. It is the unfortunate thing about, you know, I think that's where the disconnect happens is that, you know, so many things, although I do believe Twilight Zone holds up, but so many things we see as children and they expand the scope of what we think an entertainment can be. So in our heads, they're the greatest things ever. And then when you're an adult and you show another adult something they haven't seen, sometimes that connection is just not there because you've seen so many things between then and now. But anyway, try to keep an open mind. Because you don't, you just try to understand.
Yes.
I mean, you must have that with your kids. Is there anything that you've shown them that you're like, oh, you have to see this? Or do you let them discover their own entertainment?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. Through a big event, we rented out, is it the former Silent Movie Theaters? Is that CineFamily or
CineFamily?
CineSpace?
Yeah.
CineFamily, to show the original 1977 Star Wars. No fucking around, like the actual 77. And bunch of kids, big screen, they loved it. But then that it was a production to put that together, and they were curious about the next movie, so I put on Empire Strikes Back at home, and it was like, eh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, when you're an adult, you realize that's the best one.
Yeah.
But I think when you're a kid, it's just too, and then so they swung back around with Jedi. You know,
I haven't shown them Jedi yet. I'm
Jedi,
scared.
They'll probably love.
They'll probably love
they
it.
They probably
yeah.
will, because it's much more. That's I think that's when they were like, well, let's make it kid friendly, and that's why they,
Ewoks,
you know, they made
whatnot.
Ewoks because they couldn't make a planet of Wookiees, which was supposed to be the original idea was supposed to be a Wookiee planet,
right.
and then the Endor, and so yeah, Ewoks, House Wookiees, basically.
I don't know what to do about parts one and two though. She wants to see them.
Oh, you mean like Phantom Menace?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, I've actually heard really that kids love those.
I'm sure.
So you can show them, you know, you can show them.
I know.
No? No, Kyle wants them. Kyle wants them stricken from the record.
Yeah, well, they ought to be. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're about to be. I mean, they're about to be now. I mean, with Force Awakens, I think it's going to be epically amazing.
I think so, too. But does it? I mean, we get really into the weeds on it. But what are those things? Midichlorians. I understand that those. I have been told that that is not a factor in The Force Awakens.
It probably isn't, because I think that was the one thing
that was the thing that really
bummed out a lot of people. Like if you know, it's like if you were to watch Harry Potter and then someone was to be like, well, we've learned that all the wizarding powers are basically just this molecule. I mean, there are some mystical things that you don't need to explain away with science. And I think, you know, midichlorians is sort of, have you heard that in a writer's room before? Like I've heard that before when something is getting too granular with why it exists. And then people go, midichlorians,
like,
well, you don't need to explain that.
Right.
You don't need to explain that.
No, I've never heard that thrown out, but we've definitely had those kind of conversations on review. Cause like, and it's a tough one. It is a really hard one to like, to what extent does something need to be really plausible and really rooted in the real world and really, you know, cause it's, I think it's satisfying to an audience when they can't poke holes in things.
Right.
You know, but you can also go way too far. You can really over-explain things, and you can just take the fun out of something by just hyper over-explaining it.
It can be hard, though, because when you know what the narrative is, the risk is that you forget to let the audience in.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you're just like a weird aunt telling a story about the family when someone has none of the reference points.
Right.
You know Larry. But no. Anyway, well, he was at it again. Went to clown college.
Yeah.
Just like always. I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
You know, but then how do you, you know, what do you think is the balance between jokes and exposition, especially with a narrative show, with a show that has a narrative like Review?
Well, like on our show, sometimes people will say, like, will comment on the fact that there are cameras and that nobody seems to see the cameras, and who knows what Forrest is up to and who doesn't know what Forrest is up to. And it's like, yeah, yes, we could hog up a lot of screen time explaining that in a way that everybody would go, ah, okay. Got it.
That's not the reaction you wanted a comedy
right,
show.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting. All the facts seem to be in order.
It all lines up, and now I can enjoy myself.
This checks out. Oh, yes. The credits are rolling.
Right.
I had no time for any of the jokes. Well, at least I understand where he was coming from.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. You know, I'm not, theoretically, there's a middle ground in there, but we've just decided to just say, like, can we just go and have fun? Let's just have fun. Let's
yeah.
Just start from fun and end on fun. You know.
And do you feel like, what do you think was the biggest thing that you learned between season two and season one?
Oh, I don't know if I would think of it as something. Gosh, what did we learn?
I mean, when you finally sat down and got to watch season one as an audience member and not as someone in the edit bay trying to make decisions on what jokes to keep and cut, did you do that? Did you watch it as just a viewer to see how it hit you?
Yes, I did. I watched it when it aired. But it's fascinating what happens there when you spend so much time working on something and you're in the weeds on every single decision
that's being made throughout the entire production. And then it gets loosed upon the world and people have their own interpretations that you never imagined. People are drawing conclusions you never thought they would. And it just is what it is. It's no longer a collection of decisions at all. It's a half hour of television. It's a story. All those decisions have been made. And so it's a very different experience watching it. It's much more enjoyable.
But did you make mental notes the whole time? Like, okay, next season we're not going to do that, or we're not going to do this, or that was strange, or no more of this.
I'm sure we did, but I can't remember any of those. I mean, one thing we did kind of say, but this was a discussion, is that in season one, there are certain reviews that feel like they could have moved to anywhere in the season because they're not deeply rooted into what is going on in Forrest's life with his relationship and everything else. And it felt like those had a little less power to them.
Right.
So that in season two, we kind of wanted to do a better job of just saying, like, everything is enmeshed with Forrest's life. You know, every topic he takes on, there's never a topic he'll just take on that doesn't in some way correspond with everything else that's going on in his life and involve the people in his life. So that was one thing. But I don't know. In general, for season two, we just kind of said, let's just go crazier.
Now, because I'm not sitting in front of your IMDb page.
Yes, yes, yes.
Have you been on three seasons of a show? Have you been on a show that's gone for three seasons?
Not really. I mean, I was in the second and third seasons of Eastbound and Down, but only like as a guest, like tangentially. So
I'm sort of wondering what that. The leap from, you know, season one usually seems to be, we're figuring this out.
Right.
Season two is, okay, we've really started to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
And season three is usually when a show, not always, but usually when a show kind of makes that meteoric leap of, now we got it down, how do we kind of raise the stakes and lock in, you know?
Mm.
So have you thought about what season three would be yet, or would you do anything differently, or would it be, you know, like, have you thought about how do we raise the stakes, or do you think it, because of the type of show it is, you don't necessarily need to do anything stunty like that?
I don't think we do, but I also really have been kind of trying not to, because the experience of making season two and one, but somehow two even more so, was so intense and so mentally and emotionally exhausting throughout, that I have been trying to kind of take a break from thinking about it altogether. But of course, thoughts creep in from time to time of different things that could happen. And I don't know. I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but there are some ways in which this season seems to be raising questions that it might be interesting to address in season three.
All right. because I don't know if comics really get enough credit for, I mean, it is exhausting.
Yeah.
And I just challenge anyone who's like, well, it's not that hard. Just try riffing with someone for like 4 hours. To just nonstop you have to keep the story making sense, but also add information that's useful for the next person, making choices, and just keep that going for several hours where you have to be that focused, and then just see what happens to your brain at the end of that time where you don't just feel like, I don't know who I am.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it always seems so effortless with you, though. That's the thing with your comedy seems so effortless, and you don't waste any words. You make strong choices and you're super committed and you lock in right away, and it doesn't ever seem like you're trying to search or find stuff. It seems like my favorite thing about riffing with you is that you just immediately lock into something.
Yeah, I try to. But I will say, like, as far as review anyway, by the time we get to the set and we're doing the things that you're seeing, there is a mindset that takes hold of just like a very positive, spontaneous, we're going with this, we're doing it, we're committed, and we're having fun. But the entire 3 months that leads up to that is a very intense and difficult period of decision making and refining, and, you know, that's where it's stressful. And then the post production is stressful because we've shot so much great stuff and we have to make hard decisions. That's the part that's really hard. But actually, when we're doing it, if it looks effortless, I think it is because everybody there is just like, we've done the hard work, more hard work is coming, this is play.
Are you even thinking about
who the character is. Like when we did the thing on Bang Bang, where you were the honorary mayor of Hollywood,
the candidate for the honorary mayor of Hollywood,
but actually, and your thing of like, I hold no political power. What is so difficult for you to understand about this?
Because
we were hitting you with questions about, well, who's going to fix all the potholes on Vine? So you know, when you're, are you defining who that character is as you're going along? Do you have strong thoughts about? I guess you can't really be thinking about it, right? Is it just all instinct for you at that point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a character I've done him a few times. I've done him on Comedy Bang Bang podcast and on my own podcast, and I sort of wrote a bit, like a 10-minute stage bit for that character to do, and came prepared for that Comedy Bang Bang TV taping to hit a lot of those beats, but was delighted, completely delighted that the two of you had other questions. And then, there wasn't a lot of thinking for me about how this character would respond to those questions because I think I knew what he was there, what the character felt he was there to say and do. And so any sort of, you know, digression from that is just like, he's going to dispatch with it as quickly as he can. And then the more you guys frustrate that desire of his, the more fun we're going to have.
I feel like we were playing with that for like an hour.
Yeah.
Those shoots are remarkably
Those
long.
Shoots are fascinating.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, you know, like there's another show that has so much extra footage.
Oh my God.
That I'm sure that they could cut a whole separate series just based on the stuff they didn't use.
No kidding. I mean, I think we did probably one 20-minute long take or something like that.
Yeah.
And then it was like, okay, I think we got it. Really? Good luck.
Then you stabbed me at the end, and then that was
yeah,
it.
That's
like,
right.
You made a blood sacrifice, mm-hmm. too. Oh, that's right, because you turned out to be a Satanist.
You're all these shards of glass.
You were a Satanist, right?
Yes,
wasn't that it?
Yes,
or
right.
You were trying to bring about the end of times or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, yeah. He's got two campaign promises. One is to bring production back to Hollywood, and the other is to conjure Satan and serve at his unholy side in darkness. Rule the world in darkness. Elect me honorary mayor of Hollywood. Yeah.
My other favorite character was the first one I ever saw you do, which was the old man, the old guy. The old
oh yeah, how did that one come about?
Did he have a name?
Ben Alterman, I named him because the first time I ever did that character and needed to come up with a name for him, Kent Alterman was in the audience.
Oh, Kent Alterman, yes, one of the guys who runs Comedy Central.
Yeah, came to see it at Improv Olympic that night. That character, I wrote a filthy joke. A filthy joke came to me, and I thought, I can't tell that joke on stage. That's disgusting. But can I come up with a character who could?
That's the beauty of characters,
right,
though.
Exactly.
You get a layer of protection.
Yeah.
You can say the most hateful things on stage as a character, because that's
yes.
You know, you don't mean that. You don't mean it.
I don't mean it.
You're framing it in this. You know.
Oh, it's so much fun. I also love it when the characters are belligerent to the audience. That is so satisfying, to be belligerent to your audience and to know that the audience knows, like, the guy behind that character doesn't hate us.
Right.
The character does.
Andy Daly is a very sweet, wonderful guy, but Ben Alterman is saying the worst.
Exactly. Yeah. That's wonderfully satisfying. I just did a few shows in San Francisco and Seattle and Portland and taking questions from the audience, doing just crowd work as characters. And it was an incredible amount of fun.
Which characters?
I did Dalton Wilcox, the cowboy poet, the poet laureate of the West, who's also terrified. He's also believes himself to be constantly under attack by vampires. just another thing about it. That's just a fact of my life.
So you feel like at any moment a vampire could come streaming through the...
Absolutely, and there's a decent chance that all three of you are vampires right now.
But it's daylight. I mean, we'd be burning up if we were...
Well, your ignorance about vampires is appalling, that they get away with anything these days.
And I'm curious, and now I'm confused, because do vampires work their way into your poetry?
Oh, sure.
What does that have to do with the Old West? I don't understand what's across...
So, well, my poem about vampires features a line, vampires, 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 with fangs as sharp as new barbed wire. So it's Western-themed vampire poetry.
Yeah.
Vampire poetry with a Western theme.
A lot of you, you know, people are sick of vampire poetry being so gothic.
Yes, precisely.
So gothic and emo and like someone, you're really a voice for the West.
His poems are called, I forget what the vampire poem is. The other one is, And Also Mummies. And then he's got a poem called I One Time Killed a Frankenstein.
Well, your album Undeadwood was really flooring. What? So you do that character?
I did that, and then I did Don DeMello, the theatrical director of the Rockettes Radio City Music Hall Christmas Spectacular. Sort of a variation on that old man character you saw back in the day. But
I don't think I know that one.
Don DeMello?
No.
Yeah. He's that character came out of, I saw an ad for the Radio City Music Hall Christmas Spectacular. It's got Santa Claus and a live nativity scene with animals on stage. And then it's got this kick line of leggy dancers. And that just seemed to be like, we just accept that. Yes, at some point the Rockettes will come out and do the can-can with the Santa Claus on stage. But if you think about it, why is that happening in the children's show? Why is this holdover from the Moulin Rouge and the Ziegfeld Follies going on there? What's that for? And so the thought was just, who's in charge of that? And he's just the most lecherous, disgusting human being that ever walked the earth.
Is it weird to put a bunch of ladies dancing in front of the nativity scene?
Oh, it's beautiful. Bring out the girls. And his whole thing is that's all he's interested in. He treats them like garbage. Just a monster. And so do that character. And for that guy to take questions, although it was weird, in San Francisco, the first question Don DeMello got was a woman yelled, "Why are you such a misogynist?" And his answer was, "Because it's the only thing that works."
But the audience responded.
Some people booed, and it was a very weird thing that happened.
You're like, I'm doing it. First of all, it sounds like Trump. And second of all, that it's a character.
It's a character, but it became a very weird thing. The line between me and the character suddenly became odd because I wasn't sure who was being accused of misogyny exactly, and to what extent did I then need to show, like, this is a character, and I know he's a monster. We're laughing and we're having fun with what a monster he is, right? Or are we taking him seriously, or are we taking me seriously, or exactly what's happening?
Right.
It became, to me, a little confusing.
And that's where satire, I mean, satire is a very powerful tool to be able to shed light on horrible people and make fun of them.
Yes.
Because, you know, again, comedians don't go out and stab people with swords. Like, this is the tool set that you have, is to highlight horrible people and make fun of it. Like, then to ridicule and go, yes, this is dumb and ridiculous and you should not be
this way.
It's
cartoonishly evil. But then she continued to boo him throughout the set. And I just couldn't tell. And at some point, almost wanted to break character and go, just to be clear, are you booing Don DeMello or me?
I was saying boo Earns.
Are you part of the fun right now or not?
You didn't know if she was yes-anding you or...
Yes, that's what I didn't
Or
know.
Actually, no, but.
Right.
No, but shut up.
That's what I didn't know.
You didn't know. Did you talk to her after the show?
It was unclear to me. No. No. But it turned out fine because, you know, just refusing to break character and respond to all those questions in that way. But it put things in a somewhat different
place. It is sort of hard sometimes to, because you do kind of want to say, like, guys, you're in a comedy show. If I came out and said, hi, I'm Andy Daly, and these are my absolute 100% beliefs, and this is a lecture. Right. Of course, you know, like, boo that guy.
Right.
But if you're in a comedy.
Just for coming to a comedy club and delivering a lecture.
Yeah. Now, there's no jokes. I'm going to say a lot of things that are very upsetting, and I mean all these things 100%. But it's you know, you want to say, like, you know, when you come in, there should be a certain amount of separation. You should know, like, you're in a safe environment. This isn't something, you know, it kind of sucks that you would have to say that, because then you sort of feel like, well, why did you come to a comedy venue? Like,
I'm torn about it, though, because in a weird way, like, it partly felt like you're bringing a real world question to a cartoon world setting,
right,
in a way, which I opened the door to by taking questions. But then I also kind of feel like maybe there's something cool about that.
Right.
Maybe there's something interesting.
Now, Bugs Bunny, as someone who burrows underground a lot, is that a statement about immigration? No. No, I just wait. What? Why are you? Shouldn't we all be on? Shouldn't we all be in cartoon land?
Yeah.
Like, you shouldn't. You know. I mean, you can ask. Yeah, I don't know. That one feels a little.
I don't know. It was interesting. Definitely was interesting. And it seemed to color the rest of the night in an odd way. Because then the next character I do is L. Ron Hubbard.
And you answer questions as L. Ron Hubbard?
I answer questions as L. Ron Hubbard.
Does he?
That is great.
I don't even know what he sounds like. Do you just say you're L. Ron Hubbard so it does not
matter?
Is that one of those
right.
ones where it doesn't matter? It's
it
just like
matter.
A guy. It's just a
I
guy.
Watched a couple of interviews with him, and I think he was. Oh boy, there's one that's really interesting where he's on the boat at this point. He really can't dock anywhere. Everybody's after him, and he's just out on the boat, and he agreed to some interview where his posture in the interview was, I'm really just retired. I'm just a harmless old fella out on a boat with a bunch of teenagers, and we're having fun out here. But it was all bullshit. Like, the pose was bullshit because he was heavily in charge and doing horrible things around the world, like literally trying to take over the nation of Rhodesia. He was not retired, but so like that sort of way that he was presenting himself didn't feel like something I could do as an impression genuinely because it was a pose. And then so I went back to an earlier interview where he's all decked out in like this loud 70s shirt with a big collar, and he's just very confident about his methods, and he has this weird facial expression where you really see his back molars when he talks. So I don't think I'm doing anything close to a decent impression of L. Ron Hubbard, but I'm trying to kind of like embody that more.
You're trying to capture the essence of who that guy is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's great fun to take questions. Probably the best question answer was in Portland. Somebody said, what's the greatest threat to Scientology? And Hubbard just said, well, the greatest threat to Scientology is information.
There was so were you at the creative arts, the technical Emmys were just over the weekend?
No, I wasn't there.
But there was I presented a couple of awards, and one of the documentaries that won was Going Clear.
Oh yeah.
And then I was on right after. I presented like five awards, so I had to. They immediately cut to me, you know, and they gave this very quick but sort of impassioned thing about, you know, like why they felt it was wrong and why that this. And it was so hard. There was like kind of a serious moment, and I censored myself, which I feel like you probably shouldn't try to do as a comic. But it was so hard not to go, oh, but the Celebrity Center is showing Ferris Bueller's Day Off,
right?
You know, because by the UCB, like they always put up these flyers and they show these.
Come join us.
They show these really cool movies from the 80s.
Indiana Jones.
Yeah, it's like you're just. Or you're just trying to absorb Gen Xers who are like, oh, weird science. Wow, no one shows that anymore.
Right. Yeah, exactly. People. And then they have the brunches and stuff like that. Like they're trying to get people who go, yeah, I know it's weird, but fuck it. I don't care. I'll sit there and watch the
it's just a movie. You know,
some point that someone's going to insinuate themselves into their experience. Are you enjoying this? You know what's interesting?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I'll stick around for Real Genius if you guys are going to show that. And, you know.
And then why wouldn't I take a personality test? It's free.
It's all free.
The communication class is only $150. 10 years later, how did I get out on this boat? Where are we?
What happened to Hot Shots Part 2? Well, we're about at an hour.
Nah.
Perfectly. We just looped over into an hour.
Unbelievable.
Would you...
You can feel it.
Would you... No, you can't. It's seamless.
No, I'm saying you have an inner clock for these things.
Oh, I thought you meant like the audience can feel it. Because here we are, hour three of Andy Daly's IMDb page. Is there any way you would? Well, first of all, Review is on. People should watch Review. You just had episode 7.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How many? 10?
10. Yes. Very exciting. Episode 8 is a very, very important one. And then 9 is insane. And then what can I tell you about 10? I don't even know what to tell you about 10.
Well, it's the 10th one.
It's the 10th one. It's the season finale.
Yeah, there's a big cliffhanger.
Who knows?
Who knows? Well, you know. You made it.
I have some idea.
Yeah. But if you can't, what time is Review on?
Thursdays at 10.
on Comedy Central.
And then also on the Comedy Central app and CC.com.
It's comical, the list of other places you can watch it.
Probably on Hulu, too, I would imagine.
I get a huge number of tweets, people tweeting at me all the time, angrily asking me when it's going to be on Hulu.
Right.
I'm really not enjoying
it. You know, my favorite one is when people from other countries are like, how come you're blocking your show? Well, first of all, that's not me. That's your country, just so you know how geoblocking works. Geoblocking, it's coming from inside the house. Like, we're not responsible for that. And also, I am not responsible for distributing the show.
I would love for people to watch Review in England. Nothing would make me happier.
If they could.
Don't yell at me.
It's not your fault.
It's not my fault.
If you can't get it. Things like show times and how things are marketed, we're not included in those conversations.
That's precisely right.
Yeah, yes. Where things are shown.
I assume we're on iTunes and CC.com and the Comedy Central app, and there's something called Verizon FlexView. we're involved with Voodoo. Are you familiar with Voodoo?
I'm familiar with Voodoo,
V-U-D-U.
Yes.
You can catch us there. Other places, on demand. The Xbox.
That
pretty
also
sure you can watch us on the
sounds
Xbox.
Very culty. Hey, friend, how come you're not into Verizon FlexView? I can flex your view.
Flex your view. I think your view is not flex enough.
Would you? Do you want to sign off the podcast? Would you sign off the podcast as Ben Alterman?
Oh, Ben Alterman?
I just love him so much.
Oh, I'm trying to think of the better Ben Alterman jokes. Here, this is how long I've been doing the bit, or how long ago I first did the bit. This is a Ben Alterman joke. My daughter gave me a VCR for Christmas. I don't know how to program it, so I just stick my cock in it and fuck it. Right? That's terrible.
The face you would always make after the You need the cardigan sweater.
Yes, an old man in a little sort of Henry Fonda on Golden Pond hat and a big pair of glasses telling jokes. My grandchildren are in the audience, and the widow Feeney doesn't look too good. She's lost a lot of weight. She asked me if I wanted a blowjob, and I says, yeah. Not because I wanted a blowjob, but because she looked like she could use the protein. It's horrible. It's just disgusting. That joke has everything.
Thank you very much, Andy Daly.
Oh, my pleasure.
I adore you. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.